أصحاب السمو والمعالي والسعادة، الضيوف الكرام، السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. أنا محدثكم هيثم زمزم، ويشرفني ويسعدني اليوم أن أرحب بكم في هذه الليلة المباركة من شهر التراحم والخير، شهر رمضان الفضيل، أعاده الله علينا وعليكم بالصحة والعافية. نستضيف في منتدى هذا اليوم عدداً من المتحدثين لمناقشة مواضيع تهدف إلى تعزيز الحوار والمعرفة وتبادل الآراء في مواضيع التسامح والتراحم في الإسلام. فمتحدثو هذه الليلة ينحدرون من أصول وأديان مختلفة، ولكنهم يتفقون جميعاً حول ضرورة نشر القيم الإسلامية الصحيحة في العالم اليوم. وقبل أن نتعرف على المتحدثين، اسمحوا لي أن أطلعكم على برنامج الجلسة لهذه الليلة. سيتحدث المحاضرون باللغة الإنجليزية، لذا يرجى إعلام المنظمين في حال أردتم الحصول على سماعة الترجمة. لقد طلبنا من كل منهم التحدث لمدة 20 دقيقة واحد تلو الآخر، ومن ثم سنفتح الباب لاستقبال أسئلتكم في نهاية الجلسة. لذا نرجو منكم تدوين أسئلتكم وتحديد اسم المحاضر على البطاقات الموجودة على مقاعدكم، علما بأن هناك 3 بطاقات، واحدة لكل متحدث. كما نود تذكيركم بأن الهاشتاغ الرسمي لحديث الليلة على تويتر هو هاشتاغ منتدى موجود. هاشتاغ منتدى. وللإطلاع على أحدث المستجدات في المستقبل، يرجى متابعتنا على تويتر تحت الاسم @sshf_uae. لنبدأ أمسيتنا بأول متحدث لهذه الليلة، والذي عين كأول إمام في جامعة نيويورك في عام 2005، وفي جامعة برينستون في عام 2006، كما يشغل منصب مدير المركز الإسلامي في جامعة نيويورك، وإمام في إدارة شرطة نيويورك. كما برز في عدة وسائل إعلامية، ومنح العديد من الجوائز في مجالات القيادة وخدمة المجتمع. رحبوا معي بالإمام خالد لطيف. Please join me in welcoming إمام خالد لطيف.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. بسم الله. The story that I was told growing up involves a young man who deeply loved his family. That he had a wife that was the object of his adoration, and the two had a young son that they had a deep care for. And the situation comes about that this young man, his mother passes away, and his elderly father now needs a place to stay. And so he goes to live in the home of this young man. And this elderly man, he is so frail, he is so fragile, he is in need of a constant care and attention. And the young man's wife is given the responsibility of providing this. She becomes agitated and frustrated and says to her husband, the young man, that I am constantly looking after the needs of your father. Won't you do something about this? And the young man, he says nothing. And then one evening they sit down to eat their dinner, and as they're eating this dinner, this old man is so fragile, he is so frail, the sheer weight of the plate that he is holding in his hands is too much for him to handle. And so it falls from his grasp onto the ground, shattering into pieces. And the young man's wife, she takes the opportunity to say to her husband that, look at what your father has done now. Look at this mess that he has made. Won't you do something about this? And the young man, he says to his elderly father that from now on, you will not eat at the same table as my wife, my son, and I. But since you cannot eat without making a mess, henceforth you will sit at this table in the corner. And since you cannot eat from the same plates that we eat off of, from now on, you will eat from this wooden bowl. And the elderly man, with a tear in his eyes, he goes and does what he is told. The next day now, this young man, he comes upon his own son. He comes upon his own child, and he sees him on the ground playing with some scraps of wood. And he wants to be with his son. He wants to play with him. He wants to participate in that which his child is doing. And so when he gets close enough to him, he says with love and adoration in his voice, "Ya Ibni, oh my son, what is it that you are doing?" And the young boy, reciprocating the same love and adoration for his father, says, "Ya Abi, oh my father, I am making a wooden bowl for you to eat out of when you get older." We learn in this manner, explicitly, implicitly, consciously, subconsciously, you and I, the individuals that we are today, is most definitely impacted by every yesterday that we were in this world. Every interaction that we were fortunate or unfortunate enough to have experienced in the course of our lives shapes the individuals that we are today. And as much as every yesterday has an impact on the I that is me that stands in front of you, the person that I am today will most definitely impact the person that I am tomorrow. And when we are trying to understand these concepts, these values of compassion and toleration, it's important for us to start our discussion here. Because the way compassion and toleration manifests itself in my life beyond an abstract or theoretical discussion is going to be based off of how I engage those values growing up. What will my understanding of compassion be? What will my understanding of mercy be? What will my understanding of toleration be if I lived and grew up in a world that was devoid of these values? If I was never engaged with a semblance of mercy, if I was surrounded by all kinds of anger, if vice was something that I regularly interacted with, today when I try to understand and find it, where would I even begin to look? Who I am today, I have certain characteristics that are beyond debate or argumentation. The person that stands in front of you, I could say easily without any dispute that I am a man, and you can't tell me otherwise. I am 29 years old, and that's something that is a fact. I could speak about my being married. I could speak about living in New York City. I could speak about so many aspects to my identity. But then there are facets of who I am that I don't get to assign to myself. But you all, having interacted with me, get to say whether I am actually those things. I don't get to make the determination as to whether I am compassionate. I don't get to make the determination as to whether I am tolerant, whether I am honest, whether I am trustworthy, whether I espouse a sense of integrity. These are not values that I can self-assign to myself. But the way that I will interact with you, the way that I engage with you, the way that I am to you will enable me to be someone who could actually possess those characteristics if you decide to say that there are things that I embody. I can't walk into this room and say, "Look at how great I am." And everybody simply acquiesces and says, "Yes, because you have said it, then that is it." But the values that can be part of my identity have to be rooted in an action that then demonstrate to you that I am those things, and you then assign them to me. In our understanding of Islam as a compassionate religion, as a tolerant religion, we can go through the pages of the Quran and we can find verse after verse after verse that speaks about mercy, that speaks about compassion, that speaks about being understanding without condition, without qualification. But the way that message propagated itself to that initial generation did not come merely from abstract concepts that existed within the pages of a text. But the individual that was chosen to propagate that message was one that espoused a sense of integrity, that the people around him knew him to only be somebody who was good. That he was somebody who spoke that message, but then he lived it in a way where in their actions they knew that Muhammad,
this messenger of God was somebody who was honest, who was merciful, who was compassionate. The Prophet Muhammad does not stand and say to the people, I am good. He does not stand in front of the people and say, I am compassionate. He does not stand in front of the people and say, I am merciful. But the people, they know him to be this. In our understanding, what our tradition tells us is that Muhammad, he is known as Al-Amin, the trustworthy one, the honest one. But he is known as this before he is known as Nabi, a prophet, a messenger. It is not a quantified amount of knowledge that elevates him to a level of goodness. But this is a man who, when he is trusted, he honors his trusts. This is a man, when he makes promises, he keeps his promises. This is a man who the staunchest of his enemies could never have a problem with anything other than his message, let alone saying even the slightest things against his character, because they knew that he was a good, honorable person. He greeted young and old, male and female. He was someone who would spend time with children. He gave of everything that he had for the sake of those who were around him, not looking at what he would lose, but always looking in the process at what someone else would gain. And in his action, we found mercy and compassion. Not just in his discourse, not just in his rhetoric. He did not say, go and be, and not follow suit on those words. But they knew that Islam was tolerant and compassionate because the man who was teaching Islam was tolerant and compassionate. How does he get to this place? How is he living in such a way where he is able to tap into the diversity of his society, engaging social classes that no one would even speak to, encouraging people to honor the rights of women in a society that sought to push people down because of their gender? In his own process of socialization, the Prophet, peace be upon him, was a man who he grew up in certain ways that had an impact on him being who he was when he received prophethood. As a child, Muhammad is born without a father. His father passes away prior to his birth. And in the absence of a father, this man is raised by four different women. His own mother, Amina, is there. And she says that when Muhammad is born, the pregnancy is such a light experience that an action that is so painful, it can only be called labor by any other woman going through it. This woman says, I felt no pain whatsoever, because the coming of Muhammad was not meant to cause hardship to anybody. This was one woman who was there in his childhood. A second woman by the name of Thawaiba, who was the emancipated servant of the Prophet's uncle, who, when the news of the birth of his nephew reached him, he was so ecstatic, he sets this woman free and says, go and nurse my nephew. A third woman by the name of Halima Sa'diya, who was from the tribe of the Banu Sa'd, that it was custom at that time in the Meccan society when a child was born that they would send the child to go and live with the tribes at the outskirts of the city. And so Muhammad was entrusted under the care of this woman. And she was a third woman who played a role in his upbringing. A fourth woman, and arguably in my opinion, one of the most interesting people in the life of Muhammad, a woman by the name of Ayman Barakah, who is at 16 years of age taken as a servant in the household of Abdullah, the Prophet's father. She is arguably the only companion of Muhammad who is with him from the day he is born until the day he passes away. And she is a fourth woman who is there when he is being socialized as a child. That as a child, when he is learning values of trust and values of care and nurture, whenever he opens his infant eyes and he is crying the way our children would cry, he is met with the tender, gentle, merciful care of a woman. How then would he be somebody who does not honor the rights of women when he is older? How then would he be somebody who is not compassionate towards women when he is in that place of responsibility? As a child, this young man, he goes from place to place, visiting person after person. He is born into the city of Mecca. He goes to the people of the Banu Sa'ad. At about 5 years of age, he starts to ask his mother, "Where is my father?" The way most children would ask their mothers if their fathers are not there. And so she takes him to Medina, where his father is buried. But for the purposes of our conversation, he is going to different peoples. He is being exposed to different customs and different norms. He is not isolated into an insular, ethnocentric mode of learning. But he is engaging diversity. And he is seeing people live in different ways. In his own home, he has this woman, Ayman Baraka, that we've spoken about, who she is not Arab. She is not Qurayshi. She is an Abyssinian woman. She's Ethiopian. Her skin is black. And so when the Prophet as a child is learning about interacting with people, when it is being normalized for him, his eyes are gazing in his own home upon someone who is close to his heart that does not look like him at all. And when he gets older, he is able to engage people that come from all walks of life. His sense of compassion, his sense of mercy is not limited just to people who are like him. But he has become in tune with the realities of those who are different from him simply by the fact that he engages people who are different than he. When we think of our gatherings and we contrast them to the paradigm of gatherings that are divine in nature, our gatherings are such that they are based off of principles of exclusivity. We are defined by a certain understanding that it's not about who we are keeping our company in, who we are letting in, but more importantly, who we are keeping out. I work at New York University, and I used to work at Princeton University. The way Princeton maintains its name, and I'll talk about Princeton and not NYU so I don't get fired from my job. At Princeton University, they let in a certain caliber of student. That you have a certain SAT score, a certain GPA, a certain extracurricular activity. And if Princeton started to let everybody in, it wouldn't be Princeton anymore. Its name, its reputation, it would change if all of a sudden its doors were open to everyone. But when you contrast this to gatherings that are divine in their nature, when we look at those gatherings that truly embody this understanding, you can have the best of creation in those gatherings and the most wretched of creation in those gatherings, and they don't take away from the majesty of the divine. Nobody says, "Why did you let this individual into this temple or synagogue? How dare this person enter into this church or this mosque?" We don't think about it in that way because those gatherings are not meant to be in that way. But much of the time, our sense of compassion is limited because we don't even know about the people who we're supposed to be compassionate towards. We don't even know their existence. We don't even know their reality. And if we don't even know that they're there, how will we even begin to show them any kind of mercy? One of the first traditions that we are taught when we are studying Islam is known as the Hadith al-Rahma, the tradition of mercy. And in this narration, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he says, "Arrahimuna yarhamuhum ar-Rahman, irhamu man fil ard, yarhamkum man fis sama." That the merciful one is merciful to those who are merciful. Be merciful on the earth. The one who is in the heavens will be merciful to you. But the idea that this narration is evoking is, don't just talk about mercy, but be merciful. Let that idea of compassion resonate in your action. Let it be something that flows from within your being and emanates into the society that's trying to understand not only if a God exists, but if that God is actually a merciful or compassionate God. And what Islam teaches is that the way that we carry forth that representation will set the standard as to whether someone will understand that or not. Why would anybody think that we are people who are compassionate or merciful after interacting with us? How would any individual understand Islam to be a religion of the values that we are discussing tonight after interacting with Muslims? We are not in a place where doctrines of theology or understanding ritualistic practice or law is going to sway a person's understanding whether or not a religion is actually something good. But what people will look to are the practitioners of those faiths. They want to understand how my being a Muslim is not something that brings benefit to me, but how my being a Muslim brings benefit to the society that I'm a part of. How am I living my faith in such a way where there won't be any other understanding other than it is something that is one of compassion, mercy, and tolerance? It's not about what Islam says, because people can take text and scripture and turn it into whatever they want it to say. I can take my argument that I want to prove, flip through the pages, and say, this proves as to why I have the right to treat you in the most atrocious of ways. And I could also look at it and say, this is why you have a right over me, and I will do whatever I can in my power to honor that right. But it will come from my deed and my action, not just simply discussion. And when we think about Muhammad, this was a man who he did much for those who were around him. And based off of the way he carried himself, the people had an understanding that he was someone who was honest, compassionate, and merciful. He would tell his companions that God is kind and he loves kindness. God is compassionate and he loves compassion. God is beautiful and he loves beauty. And in our conversations today, we don't really see these things being discussed. We've turned Islam into a religion of do's and don'ts. We've turned it into something that's restrictive as opposed to expansive, something that is not rearing the benefit that the implementation of it is meant to interject into a society. And if I am not someone who is doing wrong by you, but I'm still not somebody who is doing right by you, this is still something that's problematic. I can't get away with saying that just because I haven't hurt you, that's enough. If there's still something that I can do that would be able to benefit you, what would really inhibit me from implementing that action? We get lost a lot in ideas of grandeur and think about things in terms of impact in the masses. But our understanding of even the smallest of actions that are rooted in well intentions and a sound sense of compassion can be the catalyst for change. And so a story that I will end with that I was taught when I was younger involves a young man who was a known author in his community. And this young man, when he wanted inspiration for his writings, he would go out and be in nature. And so one day he is walking along the shoreline of a sea, and as he is walking down this shoreline, he sees a figure in the distance, and it intrigues him. It looks as if it's doing some kind of dance. And when he gets closer, he sees that the figure is not dancing, but it seems to be picking something up off of the ground and throwing it into the ocean. And when he gets even closer, he sees that upon the shore there are thousands and thousands of starfish. And there is a young boy who is picking them up and throwing them into the sea. When he gets close enough to engage this young man, he asks him, "What is it that you are doing?" And the young boy, he says, "I'm throwing the fish back into the water." And the author, he says to him that, "Why are you doing this?" And he says, "They have washed up onto the shore with the tide, and if I don't do so, they will lose all of their water, and they will surely die." And the young author, he looks up and down the coast, and all he sees is fish upon fish. And he looks to the boy, and he says, "There are so many. There is no way you will be able to get all of them back into this water. What is the point of what you are doing? What difference will it make?" And the young boy, he looks at the man, he looks down at the ground, he picks up one of the fish, throws it into the sea, and says it made a difference to that one. If you can affect even one heart with an act of compassion, don't keep yourself from doing it. If you have the ability to engage in even one act of goodness, something that will benefit somebody else, don't look at what you will lose, but see what the other will gain. Because that one act could be the catalyst of a much needed sense of compassion and mercy that much of this world is devoid of right now. But if you hold on to it for yourself, then the rest of us will be prevented from benefiting from that blessing that can only uniquely come from you. Thank you.